Welcome to The B Word, a podcast about humans, organizations, behavior. I'm your host, James Healy. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want you to imagine a world. It's a world where houses and office buildings are designed by people without architectural qualifications. A world where planes are designed, maintained, and flown by amateurs who've never studied engineering or aeronautics. A world where anyone can become a surgeon without having to study medicine. Is it a world you'd want to live in? I thought not. When it comes to construction, aviation, or medicine, we insist that people have certain minimum qualifications, that they know what they're doing. Otherwise, buildings will collapse, planes will fall out of the sky, people will die. I now want you to think about organizations, about work. Work has a huge impact on all of us. We spend large portions of our lives at work, or thinking about work, and I think most of us recognize the impact that work has on our physical and mental well-being, our personal lives, our families, and our friends. You might think then that the people who design work would be like architects, engineers, or surgeons. They'd need to know what they're doing. So I'll ask you a question. How much does your boss know about humans? How well does he or she understand neuroscience or psychology? How much does your organization know, or even think, about humans, human behavior, or human brains? Unless you're a psychologist, neurosurgeon, or an academic in the neuroscience department, I suspect the answer is not at all. But we all tend to assume that because we're human, we naturally understand humans, and therefore we can shape our lives, our organizations, our work, to make them work for ourselves and for other humans. Today's guest is someone who helps organizations to better understand humans and human brains, so that they can make work work for humans. Hilary Scarlett is an international speaker, consultant, and author. Her work has spanned Europe, North America, and Asia, and focuses on helping leaders in the private and public sectors to introduce change efficiently and effectively. In particular, she designs masterclasses and workshops based on the belief that if we can understand our brains better, we can work with that knowledge and help improve both our well-being and performance at work. Hilary holds an MA from Cambridge University, has a postgraduate certificate in the psychology of organizational development and change, and is an accredited executive coach with the Institute of Leadership and Management. Hilary works with neuroscientists in the UK and the USA, bringing their work out of the lab and into the workplace in a practical and accessible way. A second edition of Hilary's book, Neuroscience for Organizational Change, an evidence-based practical guide to managing change, was published in 2019. Hilary published Brain Power at Work, Tips on Building a Brain-Friendly Workplace, in 2022. And in 2024, Hilary and I, and an amazing group of collaborators, co-authored The Future of Change Management. Hilary is a member of the British Neuroscience Association and the British Psychological Society. Hilary, good morning, good afternoon. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
So we're going to talk about the neuroscience of change. Let's start with a seemingly basic question, which I don't think has a basic answer. Why do we have brains? What is the purpose of brains in the first place?
Well, that's an interesting question, actually, because there are various theories as to why we have brains. And one of the interesting ones, I think, is about movement, that do we have brains to help us move? And the argument behind that one is because there's a creature called the sea squirt. And when it's moving around, it has a kind of brain. Then it sort of lands itself somewhere, stays there, and the brain disappears. So there is an argument, is it about movement? Certainly a lot of what the brain is doing, it's about survival. That's its key driver, is helping us survive. So constantly weighing up what we need to do or what's worth doing in order to keep us alive.
The sea squirt. I did not have that on my podcast bingo card for today.
No, it's an interesting one. And it's an interesting theory, yeah. So some people say, is it about movement? Is that what it is? So I think it's an interesting one, yeah, the sea squirt.
I think the key thing for me there is almost less the answer about why we have brains and what the brain is for, but more about what we don't have brains for, or I guess the counterfactual. Brains didn't evolve for thinking. They evolved for survival. And I think that's such a key fact that people forget or don't know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's right, that the key goal, the key overarching goal for our brains is survival. They just want us to make it through the day, safely through the day. That's the key goal, the overarching goal for our brains. And therefore, to achieve that, there's kind of two key things they want to do. They want to seek out rewards, food, those kind of things, but also they want to avoid threats. So, yeah, after the savannah, the saber-toothed tiger or whatever. And those become the two kind of key goals or sub-goals in terms of survival. But of the two, because survival is the overarching goal, the threat response is much stronger than the reward response, because we can do without shelter, food, even water sometimes for up to about a week. But if the saber-toothed tiger or whatever gets you, that's it. Game over. You're dead. So our brains are much more interested in the threats and the negatives around us than they are in the positives. And again, I think it's an important thing to keep in our minds. That's kind of what our brains are constantly looking out for.
Well, obviously, there are no saber-toothed tigers, at least for most of us, in our day jobs. But there is often a sense of threat. And I think we'll come back to that in a moment or two.
Right.
One of the other key features of brains, and the listeners have heard a little bit about this in the previous two episodes, is this reliance on prediction. And this is something that I think is very surprising to most people. It was very surprising for me when I first heard about this. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that too relates to this drive for survival. That you're absolutely right that brains are often referred to as prediction machines in neuroscience, because our brains are constantly subconsciously trying to predict, trying to make meaning. They want to know what's coming up. And again, in terms of survival terms, if we were out on the savannah, the ancient savannah, and there was a rustle in the undergrowth, and your brain can predict that might be a snake or a tiger or whatever, your brain's in a better place to protect you. So our brains are constantly trying to predict, trying to make meaning, wanting to know what's coming up next, wanting to know what someone's going to say next, so they can better protect us. So as you said, it's one of those surprising things, but it's what our brains are constantly doing. And in any given situation, brains are kind of weighing up, how does this fit with my previous experience? Does it fit with it or not? So it's a really important part of what our brains do.
It seems like there's a number of implications of that. One is foremost in my mind, and perhaps it's because I was predicting what you would say, but is confirmation bias. We're essentially looking to confirm what we've already predicted, right?
Absolutely, because from a brain point of view, it's easier to, on the whole, to stick with what we already believe. So we're looking for things that confirm what we already believe. And I think in terms of things like change, one thing that's really important is, you know, if I've been through change before in an organization, you're telling me change is coming up in this organization, that if I've been through change before and I found it difficult and painful, the subconscious voice in my head will be saying, watch out, here comes change again, and you find it difficult, you find it painful. If, on the other hand, I've been through change before, and in the current organization or previous one, and actually I quite enjoyed it, I learned a lot, gave me great opportunities, then the subconscious voice in my head is more likely to be saying, well, this could be interesting, this could be good for you. And as you say, our brains like to be right. So if I think the changes that are being mentioned are wrong-headed, a mistake, I will hear all the flaws and all the weaknesses. If I think it's a good idea, I will tend to hear the benefits and the positives. So again, it's one of those reasons why we hear things differently and perceive things differently, because of our different past experiences and wanting to be right in terms of confirming them.
So that phrase you use there, it's a phrase we all use colloquially, or some version of, we hear things differently, we see things differently. I think it's a lot more accurate than most people would probably realize.
Absolutely.
We all see reality, don't we, Hillary?
Yeah, exactly. That's what we think. But actually, no, absolutely. And what I agree with you. I think one of the really useful findings from the world of neuroscience is that we do all see the world differently. And there's a big message about we all need to stay humble. How I see the world is just how I see the world. And things that influence that are past experience having a big impact on what we take in, as I've mentioned, current circumstances, personality. So all of those things will influence what we take in. So the message is we all need to stay humble. How I see the world is just how my brain filters for it. And every brain will filter differently because we've all got different circumstances, personality, past experiences. So I think it's one of those things we've got to stay humble on that. And one of the things I use in some of my sessions, I don't know whether you remember that, I think it's from 2015, that dress that was it white and gold or was it black or blue? I don't know if you remember that dress that kind of went viral because somebody saw it and they just saw completely different colours. And I quite often use that dress in my sessions now, actually, because, you know, I could put it up and say, well, I see it as these set of colours. And people say it's a completely different set of colours. And it just brings home even things like the colour of a dress we can see differently because of the different assumptions our brains are making about the lighting or whatever on that dress. So I think that dress just brings home, for those who remember it, that brains filter differently. And I just think on a very practical note, you know, I think at the end of any meeting, we need to kind of stop, pause, and just before we end the meeting, say to people, what have we just agreed? What have we just discussed? Because otherwise you do get that experience that I'm sure a lot of us have had of people will walk away from that meeting, turn off Teams or Zoom or whatever, and people think different things. They think they've heard different things. And it's not because people are being perverse or stupid. It's just what our brains do. They all filter differently. We hear different things. We come to different conclusions. So that importance of checking out with people, what have we just agreed? What have we just said, is so important.
I'm glad you brought up that dress. I only relatively recently discovered that. And
oh, right.
If listeners have not seen that, I'd urge you to find it. I think I'm right in saying that amid the sort of mass hysteria on social media about whether it was, I think white and silver, white and gold or blue,
white gold
black,
or black and black. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
I think the high point of this was Kim Kardashian and Kanye West having some kind of marital spat online about which color it was.
I missed that bit. All right.
To be serious for a moment, I think I'm right in saying that one of the reasons the brain tends to rely on prediction is because it's energy efficient or it's energy efficient to do so. And the brain uses a lot of energy.
Yeah.
What does that mean for the way we work? What does that mean for modern ways of working?
Yeah, again, it's a really interesting question. And again, an important point that, as you say, our brains are 2% of our body weight, but they use up about 20% of our energy. And in some ways, it's almost as if our brains know that they use up this disproportionate amount of energy. So if our brains can, they want to be lazy. They like habits. So I think, again, in the workplace, it's one of those areas where we've kind of got to pinch ourselves and think, am I running this meeting in the best way or am I running it in the way I've always run it? Because your brain will tend to say, just keep running in the same old way. Our brains like habits. They want to conserve energy. And also, a research shows that habits feel less stressful to the brain as well. So it is one of the things we kind of got to watch out for, that brains, on the whole, like things to stay as they are, say, because they can predict, because habits feel less effortful to the brain. So it's one of the things that can be difficult in terms of organizational change that I think we've probably all come across it, people saying, oh, why can't things just stay as they are? Why can't we just carry on with the current system? And that's what brains do. They like to stick with the current situation.
Do you think we're setting our brains up for success with this world of Teams calls? I know we're on a Teams call right now. They're not terrible things necessarily, but constant Teams calls, constant notifications, virtual working, less face-to-face certainly than we were all used to 4 or 5 years ago. Do you think this is a way of working that's well-designed from a brain point of view?
I mean, as you say, you know, hurrah for Teams and Zoom that they kept us working through the lockdowns and whatever. They are hugely useful. We can work across the world as you and I are right now. They have their real uses. But in many ways, the way we're setting up the world of work is the opposite of what our brains need to focus and to concentrate. So as you say, you know, emails popping up, messages popping up on phones, whatever, is hugely distracting. And there's some really interesting research actually came out a few years ago on a large base, and everyone's going to be given difficult cognitive tasks to do on screen. And one group, a third of the group were told you can have your mobile phone, your device on the desk in front of you, but sound off face down. Second group was told, please put your phone, also sound off, in a bag out of sight. Third group was told, just please put your mobile phone, your device into another room. Then all three groups were given the same difficult cognitive task to do on screen. The group who did the best were the group that left their mobile phone in another room. The group who did the worst were the group that could see their mobile phone on the desk in front of them. And I think that research brings home these mobile phones, these devices, even face down, sound off, they're still kind of beaming messages at us of, look at me, look at me. I might have something interesting for you. So hugely distracting. And I know I get hugely distracted by my phone. So right now, my phone is in another room because I want to concentrate on speaking with you. And I do encourage people during sessions, online sessions, if you can, put your phones out of sight somewhere else. It's a really important thing to do because otherwise they are just hugely distracting. And I also say to people, again, if they can, I think it's a really good idea for each week, maybe an hour or two, whatever's possible, just to carve out some thinking time. Phone off, stop emails from popping up, don't want to be disturbed by colleagues. Because if we want to do deep thinking, that's what we've got to do. We can't do it if suddenly a message might pop up or someone might disturb us. So hurrah for technology in many ways. But yeah, absolutely, we've got to learn to manage it so that we can still get that deep thinking time and concentration and focus. Or indeed creativity, because again, that happens. It's a quiet brain that leads us to have those moments of insight and those creative thoughts, not a distracted brain.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fascinating and incredible that the mere presence of the phone, the mere existence of the phone on the desk is enough to distract you.
Yeah.
I know it's a huge topic at the moment, Jonathan Haidt's book has attracted a lot of publicity. I know there's some controversy about it as well, but I saw an interview with him a couple of days ago and he was talking specifically about schools. And the way he described it was, if you go back to when we were young, and when I say we, I mean those of us who are old enough to remember a period before the smartphone.
Yes. Yep.
If you can imagine being at school and on your desk in front of you was a computer games console and a telescope and a Swiss Army knife and a pile of comic books and all of the other things that you would much rather be doing, and then your teacher is trying to talk to you about geometry, what, of course, would be the success of that? How would that go? And I think it's such a great metaphor for this change that's happened over the last, I mean, what is it? It's not even 20 years since the iPhone. I think we're still figuring out how to cope with this technology. And we've had, 15, 20 years of the technology, but our brains evolve very slowly.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think we've got to say hurrah for the many benefits technology brings, but I think we have got to learn to manage it. And yeah, and I guess kind of discipline ourselves. Because I know my mobile phone is incredibly distracting and tempting to look at. So yeah, I do put it elsewhere out of sight if I really need to concentrate.
So moving on from technology, or I guess moving parallel to technology somewhat, I want to talk a little bit about the social brain, about the social aspects of work, because I think, again, this is something that is quite surprising on some levels for people. I think we tend to think in the abstract that, you know, our brains are very logical calculation machines. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the social aspects of brains, about the way that the brain relies on interaction with other humans?
No, absolutely. I think it is a really important area. And I think, and actually one of the positive things in a way that came out of the lockdowns was some of the research around social brains, that the, you know, that the lack of social interaction, the impact upon us as human beings. But yeah, we are deeply, deeply social creatures. And I think it's one of those areas that we probably get in our personal lives, but perhaps don't quite get so much at work. I think historically in organizations, we've kind of expected employees to walk through the workplace door, so to speak, or turn teams on in the morning. And somehow relationships shouldn't quite matter to us in quite the same way because we're professionals, so they shouldn't matter. But they absolutely do. We are deeply, deeply social creatures. Various reasons why. One, you know, we, as humans, as mammals, as we start out as babies, and as babies, we wouldn't make it through our first months and years of life without somebody looking after us. And babies will scream and cry when they're hungry, when they're tired, but also when they're separated from their caregiver, because babies absolutely know, is somebody interested in me? I'll be okay. If not, I won't be okay. And that kind of carries on throughout our lives, maybe less overtly, but I think at work with thinking, you know, is my manager interested in me? Do they care about me? If they do, I'm okay. If not, I'm not okay. And another key part of it is it goes back to that point about, again, our brains kind of still think they're out on the savannah in many ways. And if you're on the savannah, if you're part of a tribe, you're much more likely to make it. So it comes back to survival again. You're much more likely to make it. If the tribe throws you out, that's a threat to your survival. So we are, again, constantly checking out, do I fit in? Do I belong? Am I part of the tribe? Am I part of the team? Am I not? And there's really interesting work done by people like Matt Lieberman and Naomi Eisenberger, where they've looked at the impact of feeling socially excluded and using a kind of cyber ball game in the scanner. And what they found was that actually when people are excluded from the game, the same part of the brain, the kind of pain network that where we'd register physical pain, is also activated when we feel social pain, when we feel socially rejected. So for the brain, it's pretty much the same parts of the brain that process both. And although we think of them as being quite distinct, from a brain point of view, both matter in terms of survival, be it a physical pain or be it social pain, be it a bit excluded, both really matter. So the brain has not evolved two different bits to process that kind of pain. And probably one of the most surprising findings, I think, from the world of neuroscience is that social pain is so real to the brain that what we call paracetamol over here, painkillers, actually reduces social pain in the same way they would reduce a headache as well. So social pain is that real to the brain. And then there's lots of also interesting research done by psychologists about the impact on our ability to think, our staying power, our resilience, if we feel socially rejected in some way, if we feel we don't quite belong and not quite part of the team. So I think one of the big messages from the world of neuroscience is how, you know, what deeply social creatures we are. There's nothing soft about social connection. It's really important in terms of people's ability to perform and to work. So I think just putting a real emphasis on that need for connection is a really useful thing that neuroscience brings.
Yeah, that paracetamol study is absolutely amazing. And I think what it illustrates is that so many of the metaphors that have sort of found their way into language actually have a really factual basis. It is the same areas of the brain, is the same systems that process physical pain, that process social pain. And as you say, that just highlights how absolutely crucial it is to us as humans. With that in mind, I'm thinking here about some of the impacts of virtual working and the fact that we seem to respond differently to pixelated images than we do to real humans. And it feels like we're less kind, we're less forgiving. Is there a neuroscientific explanation for that? Are there findings that support that? Or is that just a hunch that I'm having?
You're absolutely right, that bit about being less forgiving. Say, for example, I'm having a bit of a bad day. I'm being a bit irritable and ratty. The voice in my head will say, you're a good person. You're just having a bit of a bad day. I will be equally forgiving to the people I see frequently if they're being a bit irritable or short or bad tempered. But if it's somebody I don't see so frequently, my brain is more likely to, and they're being difficult, my brain is more likely to go, they're not a very nice person, are they? So you're absolutely right. We are kinder and more forgiving to the people we see frequently. And again, you can kind of see why. Our brains still think that out on the savannah. Our brains think the people say I see day in, day out, that's my tribe. They've got my back. I trust them. Our brains think the people we don't see so frequently, well, they must be from another tribe, so I don't trust them in quite the same way. So research does show, yes, we are much less forgiving to the people we don't see so frequently. So it is one of the things I think we've got to think about in terms of hybrid working, geographically scattered organisations. How do we connect people so that we're as forgiving to the people we don't see so frequently as we are to the people we see day in, day out? So it is one of the things that the importance of social connection at work, the importance that we do come together at least some of the time to do that, to maintain that sense of tribe, I guess.
Yeah, it's always interesting to bring things back to tribes and to sort of think in those tribal terms. And it's very easy to forget that it's only a few thousand years since that's how the whole of humanity was living.
Yes, yeah.
And that in-group, out-group, us and them thinking permeates so much of what we do and the way that we react to things.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, your brain scans show that we process things that are said by people in our in-group, the people we're close to, we process differently from the things that are said by people in our out-group. If someone's in our in-group, we're kind of processing what they're saying much more as if it's almost us saying it. If it's somebody in our out-group, we process in a different way. We're more challenging, more questioning. We see people less as individuals. So those in-groups, out-groups really matter. Good news, bad news, they are flexible. So good news, in-groups are quite flexible, but so too are out-groups. But it's one of those things we can work on at work in terms of, improving the in-groups and therefore caring about people that bit more.
So let's move on a little bit. I wanted to talk now about this concept of flow. And it's a term that people may have heard, particularly in a sporting context. It's often referred to as being in the zone. I want to understand a little bit about what is flow? How do we cultivate it? And crucially, how do you pronounce the name of the researcher who identified this concept?
Well, I'll have a go at it. I think it's Csikszent Mihalyi, but I might be wrong on that. But you're right. It's one of those names. You think, oh, anyway, the man whose name begins with C. And yes, so flow. Yeah, it's a really. I think what's interesting about this again too is that, flow are those moments when we really feel we're performing at our best, as you say, often referred to in sports and athletes. Those moments when I know tennis players will say they're hitting the ball and it feels like the tennis ball is the size of a football because they can just see it so well and they're timing it so well. So it's those moments when we're really performing at our best. And the interesting thing about flow, I think, from a brain point of view, is that we do need some stress to get there. It's not that our brains perform best when there's no stress. We do need some stress to get us there. But it's a fine balance. And in fact, the prefrontal cortex is part of the brain behind our foreheads. It's so important in terms of the work that we all do. It's often referred to as executive center of the brain because it's the part of the brain where we do a lot of thinking and emotional control and working memory. That part of the brain, it does need some stress to get it going, but it's a fine balance. And often the prefrontal cortex is actually referred to as the Goldilocks of the brain because it's got to be just right. That balance between I'm challenged, I'm stretched, but I'm up to it and I can do it. And it's when we're in those moments of I am feeling challenged and stretched, there's a bit of stress there, but I know I can do it. That's when we really work at our best. And it's finding that balance for each of us each day as much as we can and for our team members as well. But just on that, some people are naturally different places on that. Some people are naturally very conscientious and they are probably the people who are going to be more easily tipped over the edge into being stressed out and overwhelmed. We've probably also all got people in our teams who work around us who are the people who need a bit of a kick up the backside. They need a tight deadline to get them going. So people are naturally different places in terms of finding that place of flow. But it's the challenge and stretch. It's some stress, but not too much. I'm up to it. I can do it. That's when we find flow. And again, so different for different people.
So essentially, we do need a bit of challenge. We do need a bit of stress. And I think most of us listening to this can probably relate to that. If you are in a completely no-stress environment, you're probably bored.
Yeah, which is a stressor in its own right. Boredom is a stressor, yeah.
What, I guess, to come on to the crux of this conversation, to talk about change, what does this mean for change and the way that humans process change, react to change, particularly in the workplace?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think organizational change can be particularly hard because often it's change that we haven't chosen. It's change that's imposed upon us. And as we mentioned earlier, you know, our brains like habits. They want to save energy. They want to conserve energy. What does change mean? It means I know I'm probably going to have to do something differently. I'm probably going to have to learn a new system. Also, our brains are prediction machines, as we touched on earlier. And again, what does change mean? Often it means I don't quite know what's coming up. So our brains find it difficult. They're prediction machines. They want to conserve energy. And organizational change often takes that away. And that bit about choice, I was working with one of the big investment banks, the technology team, a while ago. And one of them said to me, how come, you know, when it comes to the latest iPhone or whatever, people are, you know, really keen to get the latest iPhone, the latest technology. But if we try and bring in technology change at work, everybody's like moans and groans and digs their heels in and don't want to do it. But I think that's a great illustration of the difference of choice, that we've chosen that new iPhone or particular piece of technology, as opposed to being change imposed upon us. So choice is hugely important to the human brain. And I think whatever the change is in organization, the question's always got to be, where can we let go? Where can we give people a bit of choice, a bit of control? It makes a big difference to the brain. And it can be quite small things, but just giving people a bit of choice, a bit of control, means we feel like we're not complete victims of what's going on here. And so the other bit about is prediction and certainty. So again, the importance of communication and information when we're going through change. Because I think we all know, we've all had that experience of perhaps going through change in organization and we don't quite know what's going to happen or what's coming up or what it means for us personally. And what the human brain will do, what we do is we will gossip, we will speculate, we'll try and create our own certainty if the organization doesn't give it to us. And because our brains, because that threat state is stronger in our brains always tend to go to how bad it's going to be around here, not how good it's going to be around here. So as people, as human beings, we can waste huge amounts of energy gossiping, speculating, trying to fill that communication vacuum if the organization doesn't give us information. So why communication is such an important part of change. And I think one of the other things for leaders to stay aware of during change is, as I mentioned, change that feels unpredictable and uncontrollable. And if we think back to COVID 4 years ago, unpredictable, uncontrollable, is particularly stressful to the human brain. And I think one of the things that leaders need to keep in mind, and I often remind them when I'm working with them, they've probably got a bit more sight over what's coming up because they're leaders in the organization. They probably feel they've got a bit more influence over what's coming up because they're senior in the organization. They need to remember that people further down the hierarchy, their brains will probably be in a more stressed place because they haven't got that same sense of control or sight of what's coming up. So I think that is really one of the things that leaders need to very much keep in mind when going through change. And another big area I would say in terms of change, one of my other kind of big things is about giving people a chance to reach their own insights about why we need to change. I work with a lot of organizations going through change. And my experience over the years is that leaders can kind of disappear into darkened rooms, come up with great plans and strategies, then emerge and kind of go into what I call broadcast mode. So saying to employees, here's why it's good for customers, here's why it's good for stakeholders, here's why it's good for you, now please get on with it. And then wonder why most employees dig their heels in and don't want to do it. But all the research from the world of neuroscience is giving people a chance to have that moment of insight to go, I get it. I can see why option A is better than B or C. It makes a big difference to our brains rather than being told A is better than B or C. Having that moment of insight, and that's what leaders often have the chance to do when they are in those darkened rooms going through all the possible options. And we just need to slightly slow down at the beginning of change, I think, and give people a chance to do that. Because, and I know some organizations say, haven't got time, got to crack on and get the change out there. But I think we have a choice. If we don't give people a bit of a chance up front to go, I get it, I can see why we're doing this, then I think we spend a heck of a lot of time afterwards trying to mop up and persuade people into change. So I think as organizations, we've got to spend some time and energy somewhere in communication, better to do it up front and give people that chance to have that moment of insight. And research does show when we have those moments of insight, oh, I get it, I know what we need to do, it does make a big difference to our brains in terms of that sense of I get it, I understand it, people are kind of more motivated, people are more resilient. So there's lots of things we can do, I think, to help people through organizational change.
Yeah, I think that point about threat response, where we started this conversation, the saber-toothed tiger on the plains of Africa, in some ways it's a silly analogy for, you know, restructuring a department or rolling out a new SAP system. But in other ways, it's a very apt metaphor because, as you said, our brains like to predict, our brains like to be right. And change makes it harder to predict. And we're likely to interpret change negatively or pessimistically, particularly if that's how we've experienced it before. This phrase that many of the listeners will have heard, I think they've heard me talk about it on previous episodes, but it's this concept which is pervasive in organizations, change fatigue. Every organization you go into, you hear this term bandied around. And one of my usual responses to that is that there isn't really any evidence that change fatigue is a thing. It's just, as you say, that people dislike having things forced upon them. They dislike uncertainty and they dislike being lectured at, which is so much of the way that change has been handled in organizations historically.
Yeah, and I think especially at the moment, this turns a bit about uncertainty. I think not only do we have uncertainty in the workplace, but I just think in the world in general, we've got so much uncertainty at the moment that I think we have a backdrop in our personal lives of a lot of uncertainty, be it about climate change, be it about politically, be it about wars, that you know, there is this general climate of uncertainty that does kind of drain our mental energy, which perhaps reduces some of our mental energy for change at work. And I think I would say, you know, I've worked in change long enough that I can remember the days when, in a way, it used to be about change programs. So it was a beginning, a middle, and an end. I do think what's different now is there is more and more change. There are layers and layers of it. So I think now, rather than, in a way, at work, about equipping people to deal with the change program, I think now what work is much more about is just equipping people to be more flexible, more resilient, because there is this constant change. And it's about how to equip people mentally, emotionally to deal with that, to be flexible. And we are incredibly flexible creatures. We are incredibly resilient. And I think, again, just thinking back to 4 years ago, to how quickly organizations and people adapted to working from home. It was remarkable. When we have to change as human beings, we absolutely do, and we absolutely can do it. And I think, again, we need to remember that we are, yeah, very flexible, very resilient. We've learned to live in all parts of the world, you know, even out in space. We are incredibly flexible, resilient creatures and adaptable.
Yeah. And I think part of that is the fact that the brain can change. And again, it's a concept that I don't know if all of the listeners will be familiar with, but this idea of neuroplasticity. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how that works and what that means?
Yeah, and I think, again, it's a really positive area from the world of neuroscience, neuroplasticity. Because I think we used to think until fairly recently that the adult brain couldn't change that much, that once you kind of reached 25, that was kind of it. The brain had peaked, and if anything, it was downhill all the way into old age. And that is true for some parts of our brain. Things like our hearing has probably already begun to decline by the age of 25. But there was, I think, the first piece of research around is quite a famous piece of research that's done here in London amongst black cab drivers. As people might know, to be a black cab driver in London, you have to have what's called the knowledge. You have to know every road in London, every place of interest, every route between them. And if the cab drivers manage to acquire that knowledge, it takes them about 4 or 5 years of learning just to acquire that sheer amount of knowledge. And what neuroscientists did here in London, they compared their brains with the brains of bus drivers in London, because in many ways, two very similar kinds of job. But what they found in the brains of the black cab drivers, because of all that learning they had done, part of the brain called the hippocampus had grown. And not only that, but the more cab drivers are out on the streets of London using the knowledge, the hippocampus grows even more. The hippocampus in the bus drivers, probably the same size as many of ours, because they haven't done that same intense learning. So this was the first bit of research that showed that the adult brain absolutely can change and learn and restructure. So this is neuroplasticity at work, that what we choose to focus on, that's what the brain gets better at. And I think in terms of change, again, I think one of the positive messages is that neuroscience suggests that learning is really good for us. That perhaps one of the reasons why our brains tend to slow down as we get older is because we don't quite challenge or stretch them in the same way we do when we're at school or college or university. So one message from the world of neuroscience will be, get out there, learn something difficult. So if you're finding learning new systems at work difficult, the message from neuroscience might be, well, good, that's good for your brain. It's challenging it. It's cognitively protective. It's building up this thing called cognitive reserve. And also there's more and more research coming out at the moment suggesting that people who keep on learning, who build up this cognitive reserve, have more protection against things like dementia in later life. Because in a sense, the more you build up, the more you can afford to lose. So learning is good for us. And also, I think one of the important messages from neuroscience is what we choose to focus on, that's what the brain gets better at. So if we choose to focus on learning or on being kind or positive, those things, the brain will get better at that. If we spend a lot of time being anxious or stressed, that's what the brain gets better at too. So that's also neuroplasticity at work. So again, I think one of the important messages, what we choose to focus on, that's what the brain gets better at. So I think things like that do give us that message. We've perhaps got a bit more choice, a bit more control over our brains than perhaps we realize.
I love the black cab driver example. It's one of those things, again, I'm going to sound like a complete Luddite in this episode, which is interesting because I think the episode after this is going to be about Gen AI. So we'll see how that goes. But I was going to say, I think it's one of the great tragedies of sort of modern technology, that knowledge with a capital K, that encyclopedic knowledge of the street layout of London is suddenly not really that relevant anymore in a world of GPS.
Yeah, you're right, because the newer cab drivers in London, the non-black cab drivers, don't have the knowledge. They use GPS, as you say,
And I do wonder, actually, just building on that, I do wonder what other detrimental impacts technology will have in terms of the ability to access the whole of human knowledge in a moment with a device in your pocket. I wonder what this means in terms of the way that we will focus our brains or the types of activity that we will do and what impact that will have on us as individuals.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I'm not sure we know yet, really. But I think, absolutely, that in a way, our brains in touch, that in a way we will use our brains differently because of as you say, if all that information is out there in terms of on the internet or wherever, then we can access it. We don't need to learn the same way. And again, I just think back to things like, I used to know people's phone numbers before the days of phone, but I don't know anybody's phone number anymore, not even my partner's, because we don't need to. But is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? It's going to be interesting, I think, how we work with technology and the benefits it will bring, but also, as we mentioned earlier, the things we've kind of got to watch out for as well, and the things we might lose as a consequence. And I think particularly just watch out that we don't make ourselves more distractible, because I think it's very easy to do with people trying to multitask, trying to have lots of different things open on the screen at once. That ability to focus, to concentrate, to hold our attention, I think that is something we've kind of got to keep working at, because I think it is important. And I think we are in danger of making ourselves more distractible.
I would definitely agree. I think, and I hope, you have managed to maintain the attention of our listeners for the last 45 minutes. I've certainly enjoyed the conversation, and I'm sure they have as well. Before we finish up, I guess to pull all of this together, what would be your neuroscientific prescription for how we can design work to set our brains up for success?
Ooh, interesting question. I think there's lots of things we can do. I think researchers, we've talked about the threat state. The opposite of that is the reward state, when our brains are in a good place. There's an absence of threat. And lots of things can help create that reward state, sort of social connection that we've talked about, feeling like we've got some control, we've talked about having some certainty, flexibility. And when our brains are in a reward state, research just suggests that we're just more curious about the world. We're more engaged. We can use our energy to kind of flow out and connect with other people, because we don't need it to kind of to protect us. We're not in survival mode anymore. So I think the more we can create the world of work that gets people into that reward state, and say we know lots of things that help create that, the better it will be. The more our brains will be freed up to be creative and curious and resilient. So that's the key thing for me, is being aware of that threat reward state, and how do we create more of the reward state at work, where employees can be engaged and thrive and be creative.
Thank you. That sounds like a world of work that we can all sign up to. If only it were the reality.
If only. But it keeps us busy, as it is not.
Thank you, Hilary. Been a great conversation.
Pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So much of the modern world of work just doesn't work. At least not for humans as we really are. Constant ineffective meetings. Endless interruptions. Human interaction replaced with messages or pixelated images. How many of us, listening to Hilary, thought, yes, this is my work day? Regular breaks. Time for deep thinking and reflection. Phone off and out of the room. No buzzing, beeping, flashing notifications. Just the right level of real, face-to-face human interaction. Or does your workday resemble an endless game of video call bingo? You're on mute. I'll just share my screen. I hope you can hear me okay. Can you see my screen? Can everyone go on mute? There's a lot of background noise. I'm conscious of time, so let's get started. And how many times an hour do you receive an email, text message, Teams or Slack post, or an incoming call that distracts your attention? When was the last time you experienced flow at work? Or in your life as a whole, actually? Hilary's comments about brains evolving to respond to threats of saber-toothed tigers and the nuances of social interaction within a tribe remind me of the famous quote from American biologist E.O. Wilson. The real problem with humanity is that we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. This gap between the world our brains evolved for and the world in which we live and work is at the heart of so much of what's wrong with work and with society in general. It's a topic I've previously explored in different ways with Don Packer in the Us and Them episode, with Robin Dunbar in Friends, Julian Tett in Anthrovision, and most disturbingly, with Omar McDoom in Following the Herd. If you haven't listened to those episodes, I recommend giving them a try. That gap I mentioned between the world our brains evolved for and the world we actually live in is only growing larger as technology improves faster and faster. Our next couple of episodes explore the human implications of the newest and most advanced technology yet, artificial intelligence. As the tech races ahead, the need to understand humans as we really are only grows. You've been listening to The B Word, a podcast produced by Izzy Rakic and Armani Williams, and hosted by me, James Healy. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.